Hello, this is David Brim, and I'm the founder of Orlando Entrepreneurs. We are the hub for Orlando entrepreneurship, and our mission is to connect, cultivate, and celebrate our local entrepreneurs. We bring together our local entrepreneurial ecosystem to help impact our entrepreneurs, their companies, and our local economy. Learn more at OrlandoEntrepreneurs.org. Now over to Josh Wilson to get forward with our show.
Good day, everyone, and welcome to the Orlando Entrepreneur Show. My name is Josh, and I'm having a conversation today with actually a follow-up guest. So Richard Milam was on our show, and if you guys haven't heard his episode, he's the founder of EnableSoft. If you haven't heard that episode, go to the show notes below and click on that so you can get some background information. So this is a follow-up conversation with Richard after the exit. So Richard, congratulations, you just exited a company.
Woohoo! Yeah, it's nice. A good day.
Nice. So why don't you tell us a little bit, you know, just briefly about who you are and what are you doing now that you exit?
Well, I'm an entrepreneur that's exited, and it's a small club, as you know. I'm a consultant and with Nintex, who was our acquirer, but I'm also doing some other coaching, mentoring, and consulting as the opportunities arise, although my therapist and my wife told me I don't sign up for any new boards or projects for at least 6 months. So I think that's the plan.
To kind of decompress and reset, right?
Exactly.
So
Or rewire.
So your wife and your therapist are not the same person?
Not the same person.
Okay, very good.
They think they are, but they're not.
Yeah. So why don't you talk to us a little bit about what is an exit? Maybe for people who are just new to entrepreneurship, what is an exit?
Well, I would first say that every enterprise or operation that's being prepared for an exit, whether it exits or not, is going to be a better organization. And so an exit is a financial event, a sale of a fraction or the entire company. I happen to sell the entire company to a strategic buyer, and happy to share that story with you today. And so there are degrees of an exit, but I had a 100% exit.
Very good. So why don't you talk to us, you know, through kind of like the story of your exit? You know, you built a company, you were running it for years, and people could go back and listen to the story. But talk to us through the story of the exit from when we spoke last.
Well, happy to do that, Josh. So it'll be 25 years this May since when I started it, and we built technology that's now called robotic process automation. There's, if you listen to the analysts, there's probably about 40 companies in the world that have it. We were probably the first to market commercially with it, and it's become a big deal in the last 4 years. So as a visionary, I saw this coming. The competition took on funding, and three of them got very big, serving mostly the bigger IT markets. And we were in this kind of juicy spot in the market in the middle where enterprises that needed to work on becoming digital enterprises and preparing for the artificial intelligence industrial revolution were trying to automate things. And so we were very focused on powerful yet easy to use technology, and the writing was clearly on the wall. There's going to be some consolidation in this RPA, robotic process automation, market. I was either going to have to leverage the company and sprint another 5 years to grow or take a strategic 100% exit. So I started having conversations with people who eventually became my team members about what that would look like, and helping them understand what we actually had, which was significant, with 650 customers worldwide, mostly banks, a lot of healthcare, using our technology, getting huge return on investments, actually pushing the needle to clean their data up and become a digital enterprise, eliminating manual and structured processes all over the place. So as we started having a conversation based on my age, because I'll be 63 this month.
Happy birthday.
Thank you.
Yeah.
Thank you. And my team, their levels of inside team, the levels of ownership and capabilities of the leadership team, the players that I needed to put in place to help execute this, one of them, the most important one being the what I call the integrator, or I call him the chief operating officer. I actually had an inside part-time general counsel for, he just told me since 2012, that helped put this together. But the other people you need are your transaction attorney, your accountant, as we'll talk, an investment banker. We chose to go that route. There's a lot of key people to help make this happen, because there's a lot of things that have to line up for a transaction to happen.
Or things could go bad real fast.
They go bad all the time.
Yeah. So you mentioned while you were speaking and sharing this story, as you were building the team, you said you saw some writing on the wall. So for people out there, like, what kind of things did you see where there was going to be a major shift in your industry where you said, I need to start preparing now to sell versus later on in 5 years?
Yeah, great question. So we built the same, worked on the same technology for 20 years before this, and then it just, you know, we were kind of just cobbling together, creating, trying to educate the market. But what became clear as I visited conferences and spoke at the places where these companies were congregating to market their product is that there was this huge mega trend of automation. And what was driving that is what's now called the artificial intelligence industrial revolution. And our piece of it, the robotics software piece of it, it was clear that that was the precursor to real AI, because little of what you hear about in AI and use a lot of commercials, most of it today is robotics. The only technologies that are ready for prime time that are artificial intelligence are voice recognition and facial recognition. But the rest of it's coming very fast, but you have to have a lot of things to make that happen. Three big things. You have to have a good team of data scientists. And for example, one of the main social media sites, they have three PhDs working on that stuff all the time. Most companies are not going to have three PhDs working on their AI.
Wow.
Yeah. You have to have a lot of good clean data. And you have to be a digital enterprise, which means you got to eliminate these manual paper processes that are all over the place, where people have spreadsheets where they do things and stuff doesn't flow from one system to another. And a digital enterprise is what I'm talking about, which is as much end-to-end automation as you can. So that's the piece we played in, the research in the market and the IT research firms were predicting it would be a $6 billion market. By a couple years from now, and it appears that's happening. There's competitors out there that are valued at $3 billion, that are just getting crazy valuations. We weren't one of them, but we had a good recognition in the market. People paid attention to us. We were positioned as a visionary because we focused on the easy to use iPhone type solution to the problem versus all the wires and connectors that IT wants to write code to make these things happen. And what happens, what also is the IT consultancies validated for us is that you cannot wait for IT to automate the companies end to end. They cannot do it. Their backlog is too much. They don't think like the operators. You have to empower the operators with tools that they can use themselves, much like when Excel came along. And so all those things started to gel together, Josh, to kind of give me a vision that we need to get ready for an event, yeah. Or one will happen to us.
Yeah, it'll either happen by choice and by design or by timing, right?
Exactly.
So about how long ago did you see this writing on the wall, and who's the first person that you said or that you told?
Well, it's about 4 to 5 years, and it had a group I called my mastermind group, was some other business leaders, and that we would meet with on a monthly basis for half a day with no agenda, and we started talking about this, and I got a lot of validation from that. But in fact, my COO actually wasn't a member of that group. So
yeah,
those groups are important. The groups where you get people in the room, whether it's CEO roundtables, that don't have a dog in the fight, so to speak, on what your decisions are, that can give you unfiltered, unbiased advice, and call you out for wrong thinking or bad ideas.
Yeah. So about 5 years ago, you're sitting around this mastermind like group that you built relationships, you had trust with. These are other thought leaders in their space, and you said, "Hey, I think I'm thinking about selling."
Mm-hmm.
And your COO is actually in that group. And what kind of advice did they give you 5 years ago?
The big advice was, go for it, but don't get greedy. You know, a small exit well done is better than trying to go for the golden ring by leveraging your company and going for the 10x that, because that's a lot harder to do, and you have to become a different kind of company, and it just adds risk. So my situation, quite frankly, is after I've invested 20 years of focusing on that solution, having most of my life leveraged in that, both financially and emotionally, I had to have reasonable expectations of what my outcome would be.
Yeah. So when you talk about realistic expectations on what your baby's worth, right? So you've been building this for 20 something years. You know, a lot of entrepreneurs are going, "This is mine," and you know, sometimes it's hard to value what is yours. So how did you come up with, over the next 5 years, you started building a team, but how did you start thinking of a dollar amount? And we're not going to go into specifics on the exact dollar amount, but how did you guys land on a dollar amount?
Well, when I got my COO to come work for me, he told me what the dollar amount was.
He said, "This is what it's going to be."
And it was a lot lower than I was thinking. In the end, it was closer to a number that I was thinking initially. So, how do you know? There's a lot of voices out there that say, you know, what a company's going to be worth or what kind of multiples you can get. I can tell you that when you get the right people in the room, they're going to tell you it's a lot less than what you're thinking. And part of that amalgam that came together is they had to get my head right. Was they wanted to know a couple things. Was I really going to do the deal? After they, you know, muscled in and put their shoulder to shovel with me, was I really going to do the deal at the end? Because that's a problem if I don't. And a lot of owners won't, because they can't pull the trigger. Or they're not ready.
Why not? What would be a reason that
think their company is worth a lot more than that? They can wait it out and get more. They emotionally can't let go because they don't know what they're going to do afterwards. Those are a couple of the big reasons. There's probably a bunch of others that I can't come to mind with.
Okay. So they started wrapping your head around this, and there was a little of a gut check of fear saying, like, are you actually going to do this?
Right.
Is your identity too wrapped up in this, or are you going to be able to pull that trigger? And the whole time, what is your wife saying in the background?
My wife is going, you really got a lot of voices in your mind, and you're working really hard. How is this going to come out well?
yeah. So, you know, fast forward, so they started kind of helping you create realistic expectations on what the exit is, the process of doing it, the team that's needed. Let's take a look, because you've been planning for 5 years. This isn't someday, you know, you woke up and you, "I'm going to sell my business," and then you went out and sold it. This is something that you planned strategically for 5 years. Now, you mentioned some of the team, a COO, you had an in-house counsel, transaction accountant, a banker, CPA, investment banker. Kind of like walk us through high level of what each of those components of the team kind of does in the selling transaction.
Yeah, so I would sell. I'd never done it before. I kind of had an idea what it was like from other people that had attempted to go through it or had been through it that I was in groups with. I had no idea how hard it really was.
Was it pretty tough?
When these when a company that's lawyered up and good at doing acquisitions, like my acquirer, they're writing a big number, big check. They're going to make sure their due diligence is as thorough as it possibly can be, and your contracts with your customers, your contracts with your vendors, the quality of the code got audited. Our code got audited by a third party. There's just a whole bunch of details that you have to be ready to give the answers to, and the answers need to be good.
Yeah,
you need to be pretty clean, and it doesn't. You're not going to do that. And our deal closed in 5 weeks, which is unheard of.
Wow.
And we wouldn't have been ready had we not gone through some cycles with preparing to submit to be analyzed by some of the IT research firms for their magic quadrants and peak analysis and stuff like that. So, I had my general counsel in there working with me to get our documents ready to be accessible in a digital format and well written, and our agreements with our partners, in good shape. So there's a lot of thought that needs to go into making sure that you're ready from a product, from a customer references. You got to pony those up. Legal and financial.
Yeah. So you mentioned that you worked with an investment banker. Can you talk to us about, what is an investment banker and how did they help with this process?
The investment banker was key. We decided early on, about 2 years out, that we didn't have the team in-house to do the work the investment banker would need to do, nor did we have the connections. Our buyer would have never found us, and we would never have found them without an investment banker. So they were key to our transaction. And they have the toolkit and the process to run you through a process to prepare you to go to market and to handle you and the prospective buyers and during the process. So we got to our investment banker because my COO had done a couple of transactions here in town, and through relationships we got looked at by this particular investment banker that was some ex Raymond James guys, and we were just lucky that they were interested. They were interested in our space. We were a little small for them, but they took us on anyway. It was a pretty big percentage of the transaction. Sometimes like about 5%, I think, 5 to 7. That's typical. And you go, well, I can do that myself. No, you can't.
It's a lot of work, right?
It's a lot of work. It's a lot of know-how. It's a lot of relationships. These were people that could pick up the phone and call either the president of a company because they've sold them companies before, or the people that run their acquisition departments, and they would listen to them. So after we interviewed them and they interviewed us, we talked to two, we picked one. And there's not a lot of investment bankers accessible here in Central Florida. That's one of our problems. That's why we need to get these stories out so little, because there's good companies being built up here that can have good exits, but we need a community that can support these activities that's here. Our investment banker was headquartered out of Tampa, but they made a lot of trips here. And then, so we went to Mark. They kind of did their due diligence on us. We started in October of 2018, and then we went through their kind of internal due diligence. We came up with a one page teaser and a code name. Our code name was Edison.
Nice.
So our buyers didn't know who we were. We were Edison. And I'm hoping that's not trade secret, but that's what we were. And then we were delighted to see that they had listened to us, and when we needed to prepare what we called a fireside chat deck, they had it 80% done for us. We needed to fill in some financial details and and vet it and everything. And because the methodology was, we're going to have sign NDAs with somebody that's interested, and they've seen our one-page Edison teaser, and we're going to have a fireside chat. And they told us, be ready to get on an airplane, go anywhere in the world, because we're going to sit down for an hour and kind of do a demo and a talk through and basically go through that deck. We never had to travel anywhere. All our fireside chats were video conference, Zoom, which was great.
That's awesome.
And so it's, we've been collecting private equity groups and strategic buyers that are interested in talking to us, and we had a discipline where we're collecting those contacts when they emailed me. And so we came up with a list of about 80 prospective buyers along with the investment banker. Then it came time for the investment banker to send me an email that says, we're ready to go to market. Here's what it looks like. Here's the process. And are you ready to sign off on going to market? And did that in December. They started making calls in early January. So about the first 3 weeks of January, there was kind of like, okay, well, what's going on? Well, they gave us an update every week, just told us the status of everything. It happened very quickly. We had 14 non-disclosure agreements signed, and there was about 10 more behind them that were interested. And believe it or not, the first fireside chat we had is the company that became our acquirer. And I can explain the reason behind that. We had about 5 fireside chats, but the first one was by far the best. And this company was very motivated because they were looking for a robotic process automation partner. And we were very attractive. They didn't even really know about us, again, because we were fairly small. It's hard to make a lot of noise. I was doing a lot of PR, as you know, but I don't think they would have found us. Given us the opportunity to show what we had and how good it was, and they got that. They were all about powerful, easy to use technology. They were very engaged. Came down to from Seattle twice in less than a week and a half, and the second visit was their CEO and VP of biz dev. They spent a good bit of time in our offices, and then we were presented with the term sheet.
So, like, how does this work? You're sitting at a table, and do you have a price by this point? Do you have a price tag on your business on that Edison sheet? Is there a price tag that says you could have all this for X, or do they come with an offer? Like, how did it
there's
work?
There's no price on the term. There's no price on the Edison document. There's an expectation of what we think we want to get, and we were all on the same page of what that kind of minimum number was. And the problem we had is that them being the first one, if it was kind of that minimum number, it was like, oh, this is going to be hard because we got to look some more. Because we're never, if we say yes to this, we never see those other term sheet offers, right? Because they'll get put on hold. Yeah. And you know, that's it. Where the investment banker did his work. So, listen, they got a lot of interest here. It needs to be kind of in this neighborhood.
Nice. And it was in that
neighborhood. And it was in that neighborhood. Right. And so we prayed about it and talked through it. And I woke up on a Saturday morning and said, I accept the terms. There was a little bit of negotiation. Yeah. Then we were off. And they were motivated to close in 5 weeks for a number of reasons, and that was a lot of hard work. There's a lot of meetings going on that I was not in.
Yeah. Were you nervous this whole time?
I wouldn't call it nervous. There was a quiet expectation and tension.
Yeah.
It was a good tension. But My key people kept me informed of what's going on. I needed to participate in a couple of those meetings. The buyers treated us with a lot of respect, and we did the same, and everybody worked hard, and you know, you're trying to close a transaction, you got six lawyers involved, four on the West Coast and two in our area, and nothing happens on time, but we got closed by, we thought we'd be closed by six at the end of the day. It was 11:30 when we left the office.
Oh my gosh. So while you're sitting there, you thought it was going to close at six, here it is, 11:30, it finally closes. What's going through your head? Because this may have been the biggest financial transaction you've ever done. I don't know.
Totally.
Okay, so it's the biggest financial transaction you've ever done to date. You know, like, and we've already said that, you know, a good exit is there's a very small club for it. So what's going through your head from 6 to 11:30 at night? Take us there.
Well, my COO was sick. He was working with a cold, and you know, you keep thinking what shoe's going to drop. What's going to happen that we can't get the deal done? And what happens if you don't get the deal done? What happens if somebody gets over emotional or, you know, gets... There's always a little wrinkle here or there. But everybody stepped up. Everybody acted like a grown up. When the little things happen, we figured things out quickly. Got worked around where necessary, and all the big important things got done. Our investment bankers, you know, operations type guy helped a great deal. Had been through this before. You know, you're working with a huge spreadsheet of here's all the waterfalls of the numbers and. I kept looking at what my number is at the end. I said, I would ask him, well, what kind of haircut am I getting in this version?
Yeah, how many zeros am I losing with every single pen stroke, right?
Yeah, but it's unbelievable. Whether it's a, you know, a small acquisition above kind of the bad neighborhood below 10 million in assets, and we were well above that, or $100 million, they're still the same details. There's no easier. Yeah. There's still the same amount of work that has to be done on any size deal.
So talk to us about, you mentioned kind of like a price point. Below 10 million, you said it's kind of like a tough neighborhood. In that. What do you mean by that?
Yeah, so this is how I was educated that, there's a different set of visibility rules and the way people treat each other above, I think, about $10 million valuation, because those people are going to do business together again and do transactions, and there's kind of acceptable behavior and rules, where you got kind of these rogue agents running around with some you know, big checkbooks, that they're doing angel investment or small deals. There's not a lot of rules, and there's a lot of things that go wrong. And so if you can get your company up into that valuation well above 10 million, where you're dealing with, you know, the reputable people that know how to do these things well, it's just a lot safer transaction for you.
And you're going to do the same amount of work or the same details of work, but it's just an easier transaction because they're kind of on their best behavior, because you're probably going to do some type of deal with them later on. Or these investment bankers are going to do business with the CEO. So everybody's playing nicely.
That's right.
Okay, that makes sense. So 11:30 happens. They said, it's a deal.
We all get back on the phone. We were been getting on the phone about every 2 hours. We all get on the phone, and the buyer representative says, I think we've got everything done. Is there anything else left to be done? And everybody, it's kind of like launching a rocket, right? Mission control, telemetry, and everybody's got green light. And he said, well, we're done. We're ready to send the wires. We're ready to push the button. Done deal. And I signed the last papers and we were done.
So, you know, like I've sold some things online before, not to compare it because it's very different, but I saw my PayPal go bing. Right? And I was like, oh, cool, you know, I made a sale. Like, talk to us through, like, the financial transaction side of an exit. Like, does it go to your bank? You know, I've never had an exit So I don't know.
And oh yeah, the wire transfer goes into your bank.
And you start getting calls from the tellers or the people at the bank.
We had a fairly big bank, one of the biggest, and so they were kind of nonchalant about it. That's another story. But, you know, we missed the wire window because we were, you know, late. We closed later than we thought. So the first thing I looked at in the morning was the bank account. I should be, like, looking at my Bible first thing in the morning. I actually did.
You looked at your
day.
Bible verse?
Yeah. I actually did that day. But there it was. The wire was there. And I showed it to my wife. So she says, that looks like that's not real, is it? And I said, yeah, it's real. And so the people getting paid bonuses and transaction fees, actually some of that had to go through payroll, and I had to spend an afternoon the next day, the afternoon in the bank
writing checks,
unnamed, trying to get them to okay a large multi-million-dollar wire transfer.
Yeah,
because it was a big bank and they like can't do anything fast.
Yeah,
so it was then there were some frustrations afterwards. So I have a new bank now.
Do you? Well, I'm taking my money. Did you take it all in quarters and, you know, head to the next one?
That would have been fun.
So, all right. So, cha-ching, you see this, showed the wife. Actually, do you remember which Bible verse you read that morning? Because you said you looked at that before your bank account. So that says something about, you know, where your priorities are. But you remember the verse you read?
Well, the one that came to mind, and I don't remember exactly when I read that day, but, you know, it was about the rich fool that stored up his treasures in barns, and so one of my first priorities was to get the tithe money into National Christian Foundation and start giving it away.
Your donor advised fund, right? So you set aside the money, get it out of your hands,
right.
And into that. Okay, so now this is interesting. A donor advised fund. Will you kind of with the National Christian Foundation?
Yes.
Okay. Will you explain to everyone what a donor advised fund is?
It is a fund that you fund through an organization like National Christian Foundation, and they manage it. They have a website for you to actually make grants from there. So you are driving the grants, but the money's out of your hands, and then there can only be used for their purposes. So, the taxable event happens when you fund the account, not when you make the donations. And there's ways for you to actually transfer stock in your company to them before the transaction to get a better tax advantage. And we did a little bit of that.
Nice. So your priorities were, okay, I want to take care of, you know, I want to give based on your belief system. And you need to do that through a donor advice fund. You spend all day in the bank trying to give bonuses and your commissions and paying those responsibilities. Let's talk about the employees. You had 30 employees and contractors working for your organization.
Yeah.
What does it look like for an employee who goes through an exit?
Well, it's scary, right? And that's why you don't tell them until the last minute, at least the people that don't need to know, because they can't do anything about it.
Yeah.
And it could not happen for whatever reason. So you in a small company, they kind of probably know anyway, but you just go as business as usual because you've got a company to run and they've got work to do, and it there's scary things that are going to happen, right? They're going to have a new boss. There may be overlap. They may not be there. We kind of knew who was not going to be there in the basically our accounting, our legal, and me and the COO, and those people were fine with it. And Nintex is making our office their East Coast office, so they have a worldwide presence. Just didn't have an office on the East Coast, so that was a perfect fit. That there's a good chance that they're keeping our product name Foxtrot for now. Foxtrot RPA. It's being celebrated and used, and they have 8,000 customers worldwide. I think 400 partners, 500 employees. They celebrated it, and when we announced it to the staff the next Monday, it was and at the same time that the wire went out on the news wire, everybody was very thrilled. And so, and they were well taken care of. I made sure everybody got some sort of check bonus. And my CEO helped me with that, identifying, you know, the amounts and to whom. And then the other leadership team had some incentive bonuses that kicked in when the transaction happened. So
it was a good day for everybody.
It was a good day for everybody. Yeah. And there were some life-changing transactions, right, where people could make a huge leap ahead in their financial plans.
Now, how did that make you feel? Because in our story, like, if people go back and listen to the other one, you drove around in your car and, like, knocking on doors and going, you know, from ATMs, like, working with ATMs to banks. And, like, go back, like, from there to now, like, all that hard work, and you changed some of these people's lives with, you know, these financial transactions, and even seeing a few extra zeros and commas in your own bank account. Like, what advice or what words of wisdom or hope or inspiration do you have for other entrepreneurs who are just getting in their car right now, knocking on doors, yeah, and building their business?
Well, this is why you do this, right? This so that you can create something that's valuable, that somebody is willing to pay big money for, and that the people that helped you along the way as much as possible get feel the weight of that blessing as well, and that you become a generous giver and steward of those resources is the coolest thing. And I'm not kidding. Giving away the bonuses and some of the checks to some of the employees, and hearing about the bonuses that came through the next day has been the most fun part of this whole thing. The other part is me just, like, worrying, hope I, you know, get to the right five wealth managers and hope I don't mess it up, right?
Yeah.
Because if it's about the money, there's never enough money. I had a number. I knew what it would, my exit magic number was based on work of a guy that wrote a book called Dancing in the End Zone.
Yeah.
And I had one of their consultants help me figure that out, and my financial planner came up with pretty much the same number. So I knew that I could be set to do whatever I wanted to going forward, and freed up to basically do paying it forward. And so once you're comfortable with that, I think, you know, you just, anything that's excess of that, you just be grateful for it and don't get too greedy.
Yeah. I'm going to ask you a personal question. I was going to ask for permission, but I might as well just dive into it. So before you had this exit event, were you giving as a practice into your donor advised fund or to your church or nonprofit groups? Like, were you actively giving prior to this exit event?
Oh, yes.
Okay.
Yeah, for at least 20 years before that.
Okay, so it was a practice. When this exit event happened, was it difficult to write that big of a check?
Oh, yeah.
Okay, I imagine
I'm
so.
I'm human.
Yeah.
I could do this with that.
Yeah.
But those practices are so ingrained in me and my family, and I knew the truth behind it. And it's not a religious show, but the Bible, there's one place where God says, test me, and it's on bringing the money in.
Yeah.
And he says, you bring it in and watch what I do.
Wow. Yeah, I can imagine that'd be pretty difficult, you know, like, because I'm a giver, and this morning I received the check, and I wrote it, and it was a good-sized check, so, like, writing it out was, but I'm practicing, and I want it to be a part of my family. Like, my wife and I, we sat down, and we gave together. And it's not huge, but it's big for us. So, like, yeah, we're practicing. Not saying that one day we might have a huge exit, but do you think that if you didn't have that built into your family, into your belief system, do you think you would have been able to give like you gave?
It would probably been very hard to do.
Yeah. What do you want to see that money do? That impact? Where do you want to see an impact happen through your money that you gave through, you know, through your donor advice fund? Where would you like to see an impact?
Well, I would like to see the church empowered to go out in the community and be engaged in sewing up the wounds and helping schools and programs where children get foster care, work better, and things like that. And yeah, not to build bigger buildings to wait for people to come, because that's not happening.
Yeah,
I think the, you know, we were talking about the Forge and the men's equipping and discipleship ministries. I think those are key. Men's value in the family has kind of been beaten down in the media, and a lot of men have become passive because of that. But I think if we have better leaders, better male leaders, will have better families and better communities.
Awesome.
So hopefully see more of that.
That's very cool. So we're recording this on April 1st. How long ago did the transaction happen?
February 28th.
Okay, so real recent.
Right.
What kind of guidelines did you set in your brain, or between you and your wife? You know, what kind of guidelines did you guys create to protect yourself? And then what's a bucket list item that you and your wife are going to do or have done? Like, bought something cool or go somewhere cool? Like, talk to us. What guidelines did you create for yourself, and what bucket list item can you share with us?
Well, we have a whole list.
Oh, yeah? Yeah,
let's hear it. We got a list.
Let's hear it.
So I think the first thing, there's some places we want to travel to. I've done a lot of travel, but certainly Australia, New Zealand, and Nintex has an office in New Zealand, actually. So some wine country in California with our children, because they like wine, which is great.
Yeah, I like wine too.
We have a place up in the North Carolina mountains, and the big bucket list item is I'll be hopefully up there all summer enjoying it and not have to be traveling a lot to keep business commitments.
There you go. Man, that's awesome. What about your wife? What is one thing, so if she's listening to this show right now, what is one thing that she wants, that she's been waiting these last years for this exit to happen? What does she want?
Well, she's been grinding it out, trying to equip her kids to succeed. They are, one of them's a doctor, and one of them's the Broadway tour of Sound of Music. So freeing them up financially from their student loans, so they're so that they are free to go forward without the burden of that, is high on her list.
That's amazing. Awesome. So if you can pass on one piece of advice for another CEO out there who's just about to plan for exiting, or who's just about to ring that bell and do the exit, what's one piece of advice for a fellow CEO just about to exit? What's one piece of advice for them?
Get the right people around you, the right team members, and have a reasonable expectation of what your outcomes are going to be.
Okay, awesome. And some of those team members might be, can you share?
The key one is the integrator, your chief operating officer, your number two, transaction lawyer, and in-house lawyer to make sure that your contracts are good, you're ready to go. That you have leaders that are going to be able to step up after you're gone, because when you do a transaction, you're not going to want to be there, and they're not going to want to depend on you. So that's, you got to get out of the day-to-day.
Yeah. What's one question that I probably should have asked you that I totally missed the ball on?
Oh, gosh, you have such great questions. How do I structure my day?
Hey, Richard, how do you structure your day now that you had an exit?
Pretty much the same. I get up, I work out, I try to have some alone devotional time, and then there's a little more golf in the week, but there's pretty much the same thing. I'm here meeting with you to try to share the experience and encourage people to be entrepreneurs.
Very cool. So if people want to learn more about you, they could go to this audio and they could go back to the show notes and listen to the first episode, which we recorded, I think, almost a year ago. And if there's another way, could they connect with you on LinkedIn? Could we share that link with them?
They can, yeah.
Okay.
Richard Milam. I'll just go ahead and give an email, rpamilam@gmail.com.
Okay. So if you guys have any questions about the process, you said earlier that if anybody wanted to ask you questions about the team that you helped build to do the exit, they can reach out to you and you could have conversations there. But guys, we'll include all these links in the show notes below. And I just want to say congratulations, you know, to you, Richard, and then to Orlando. This is something that we can celebrate together to show that Orlando really is a great place to build a company, to invest in companies, and to sell a company.
Yeah,
so,
it is.
Yeah, so Richard, thanks congratulations. Thanks for doing
this. Thank you.
Yeah, absolutely. Ladies and gentlemen, thanks for listening into the show. I encourage you to reach out to Richard and congratulate him and ask him some awesome questions. And guys, I hope you have a wonderful day. Build some awesome stuff, sell some awesome businesses, and we'll talk to you all on the next episode. Goodbye, everyone.
Thank you for listening in on today's episode. If you would like to be a guest on the show or start a conversation with me, Josh, your host, send me an email to josh@orlandoentrepreneurs.org. You can also find out more information on Orlando's entrepreneurial ecosystem, discover resources to help you start and grow your business, and subscribe to future shows by visiting www.orlandoentrepreneurs.org.